Marika Sosnowski is a legal scholar in Melbourne. Her interest is the role of law in revolutions and state violence. Syria has been a focus of her work on that subject. But as she studied Syria, the role of her own family in the early years of Israel came into focus. In particular, the part of her great uncle Chaim played in the slaughter of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip in the 1950s. She's now woven together a personal tale of two countries, of Israel and Syria, of Muslims and Jews. She's called the book 58 Facets on Law, Violence and Revolution. And Marika joins me from the Melbourne Law School, where she's a senior research fellow. Marika, welcome.
Thanks so much, David, for having me on the show.
Marika, your job title is legal anthropologist. What's that?
Basically, that's a fancy academic term to say that I'm interested in the way the law shows up in people's lives at an everyday level. And that's, I guess, what I've been doing with my work for the last sort of 5, 10, 15 years now, looking at how the law has sort of shaped the lives of Syrians in particularly, but also other people directly.
Not just by being prosecuted or stopped in your tracks or those kinds of things, but how the law itself just quietly shapes people's lives.
That's right. I think we sometimes don't think about the law very often, or we think it's something very formal that, you know, only happens with courts and with lawyers and judges. But actually, there's quite a lot of research that says the law is actually everywhere when we think about it. It regulates how we drive. It regulates how we travel. It regulates basically almost all aspects of our lives. And what we do as people is we tend to internalize how the law works. And that's what I'm really interested in, is I guess how the emotional and kind of psychological relationship people have with the law.
And that's how the law is supposed to work, isn't it?
As something that sort of happens in the background.
Yes.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, we don't want to, well, in most places, I guess, well, in a country like Australia, I guess it does happen a lot in the background because I guess for the majority of people, we don't think about it very often. But I think if you're a minority in this country even, you probably think about the law quite a lot more, particularly in certain situations when you come into contact with, for example, police officers or different agents of the state. The law can take on different guises for you.
And you were brought up short, literally, actually, when you found yourself in Australia at the most unfamiliar thing in this country but so familiar around the world, a checkpoint.
Yes, I had an interesting experience at a checkpoint during the COVID lockdowns just in Melbourne. So probably many listeners remember that time all too well. So the Andrews government had set up what they called the ring of steel around Melbourne. And I was stopped at that time in my car and forced into a lane where I had to have my identity documents checked by what was actually then an army officer. And I think it triggered me in ways that I wasn't particularly prepared for at that time, because the only other time I'd actually encountered a checkpoint like that had been during field work that I'd done in the Middle East. And it really challenged me to think about how what I think happens over there to other people that I've been working on actually happens here now to people like me and you and everyone, actually. And I guess that experience was both kind of isolating in many ways, but also very conjoining. And that was one of the things that spurred a lot of the thinking that came out in this book.
You're fascinated by the role of checkpoints and camps.
I am. Well, in the book, I use those two places or those ideas as basically physical manifestations of places where violence and the law come together, and they affect people, like I said, in these very physical, emotional and psychological ways. And so I use these ideas of checkpoints and camps, but very broadly defined. So, for example, when we think about camps, we often, our minds go to the quintessential camps, I guess, of the Third Reich, the Nazi death camps, and that's been my family's own experience as well. But then when we broaden that definition a little bit to be places where the law is absent or it's deliberately taken away from people by the state. We can include places like I write about in the book, like the town of Diraya in Syria, which was besieged by the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad for 4 or 5 years, where literally no food or supplies could get into that town. And basically law inside that town was suspended, and they had to very skillfully make law for themselves. So I argue in the book that Diraya could be seen as a kind of camp as well. But then also we could look even closer to home and think about places like a hotel room in the centre of Melbourne where an asylum seeker was held for 14 months by our own government without much access to fresh air or sunlight. And could that be in some sort of conceptualization thought of as a camp as well.
And you write about those Australian, in inverted commas, camps as a legal construction aimed at enabling people to arrive yet not arrive.
So I use the work here of Suvendrini Pereira, who talks about this idea of not Australia, where the law is used as basically a way to exclude certain types of people. And that's not only in the asylum, in the refugee regime, that can be in all sorts of things where the law always has this underbelly of violence. And so the way the law is practiced, it's often has an exclusionary nature.
But the law always has in the background, doesn't it, punishment if it is not obeyed?
I guess in the societies that we've set up, that is the conceptualization of law, that basically people need the threat of violence to adhere to the law. Obviously, scholars have other ideas or think that there might be other ways that we could set up society. These are kind of utopian dreams, but basically the idea is that people will only adhere to the law or mostly adhere to the law unless there's a threat of violence behind that law, basically, that you will either get a fine, you will get imprisoned or worse, potentially.
But you're very interested in those laws which are violence themselves.
I guess what I'm interested in is making connections, I guess, what might actually at first glance seem like odd connections between certain laws and future and past events. So that's something that the book does. So I called it 58 Facets. Because 58 facets is the amount of facets that a diamond can be cut to reflect and refract light perfectly in a brilliant kind of pattern. And obviously that's a nod to the Jewish history in the diamond trade. But actually it's a way to sort of place stories next to each other that they, not in a way to say, look, these stories are similar or different. It's a way to say, look, if we build stories in a kind of diamond pattern, they reflect and refract each other. And so we get a brighter and more clearer picture. And so one of those strange connections that I make in the book is, for example, is the Israeli names law that came into effect in Israel in 1956. And it was a law that stipulated that all residents of Israel needed to have a first and a last name. So on the surface, it looked relatively banal, but obviously laws often have dual usage. So it was a way to create surveillance of the population. It was also a way to document the population so, social services could be given to the population. So it had both good and bad ends. But then later we see in 1967, that same law was used by what was then called Elbit Computers, which became Elbit Systems, with their first computerized civil registry system, which required the first and last names that Israeli names law in 1956 had mandated. And then, of course, in 2023 and subsequently in Gaza, we see Elbit Systems, using first and last names, you know, that were mandated by the 1956 law as part of AI targeting systems of Palestinians in the West Bank. So all these kind of reflected stories throughout history.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Marika Sosnowski from the Melbourne Law School about her book, 58 Facets. Now, Marika, when you were growing up, did you know about your great-uncle Charles?
We had family stories about a lot of the family history, but I didn't know. I knew a little bit about my uncle, great-uncle Charles, but not a lot.
Do you think your parents knew?
I don't think my parents knew the details about his involvement in Gaza. I think that is something that came later. But he was always known as a very charismatic man in our family, with a penchant for languages and very suave, erudite kind of guy.
In 1947, after he'd been demobilised from the British Army, there was a knock on his door. Who was knocking and why?
So Charles had this amazing kind of history, actually, where he fled Europe in the 1930s, early 1940s, after he experienced kind of gross anti-Semitism and aerial bombardment directly by Nazi forces. And then him and his family, so my family, my grandfather and my grandmother, a separate family, crossed at the French-Spanish border with a visa that had been issued in contravention of the law by the then Portuguese Consul General to France.
A hero.
Very much so, a very undersung hero, Aristide de Sousa Mendes. And they crossed that border just minutes ahead of Nazi occupiers, actually. And then Charles had this amazing story where the family went on to the Dutch East Indies, because they were from the Netherlands originally, and obviously there was a colonial connection there. He ended up, as you say, in London through a series of events, and then a rabbi, apparently the family story goes, asked him to come and be part of what he, I guess, saw as a revolutionary moment in Palestine to fight for a Jewish state, basically. So he became a leading figure in the Haganah, which was a large precursor to the Israel Defense Forces. And then after that, in 1956, he became governor of Gaza and sort of oversaw war crimes there. But also, interestingly, I think for me, carried out a census on the population while he was governor of Gaza for a short time there. And it makes me wonder again about those strange connections about why am I so interested in civil registry systems and
yes,
documenting people and those kind of things.
While he was governor of Gaza, two of the, if I'm not sure that the word iconic is correct, but two of the most memorable slaughters occurred in Gaza, one at Khan Yunis, one at Rafah. And do you see those as happening under his command?
Well, he was certainly in charge of the Gaza Strip at that time. And I think, look, what's interesting to me about Charles's story, and I mean, it's actually a relatively small part of the book, but in a way it's an extreme example of the fact that we can be in our lifetimes victims sometimes, we can be perpetrators sometimes, we can be revolutionaries depending on who's telling the story or how it's seen, but often we're all of those things all at once. And so his story in a way is an extreme example of those things, but actually the Syrian stories that I use in the book are in a way much more interesting to me because they are much more complicated, and I think they're much closer to our own grappling with, would we do the right thing under pressure? Would we also, what would we do under pressure? And what would we choose? Would we choose to what would we choose to put on the line and fight for?
It's so easy to to think you could answer that question looking back in time. It's so much easier to answer retrospectively than when you're looking at issues today.
That's completely right. I mean, we all like to think that we would, you know, in inverted commas, do the right thing. But obviously those questions, when confronted with the violence of the law, are very complicated. I mean, I can tell you the story of my Syrian friend Marda, who had this experience at a checkpoint in Damascus during the early years of the uprising.
Yeah.
And she was walking with her boyfriend, and they were stopped at a checkpoint. And because her boyfriend was from a rebel-occupied town of Douma, he was a Sunni Muslim, the guards at the checkpoint threatened to take him away. And at that moment, she didn't want him to be taken away, because obviously in Assad's Syria, that means, you know, imprisonment usually without trial, and could mean torture, could even mean death. And so she said to the guards, "Huwa min jamiatna," he's with us, which basically was showing the guards that she was an Alawite, like the same sect as the president, Bashar al-Assad, and like most of his supporters that manned checkpoints. And so because she said that, and she said, he's with us, he's an ally to us Alawites, they actually let her boyfriend go at that time. But then they walked away from the checkpoint and she started to cry, because she thought, it was a total fluke that I was born to be an Alawite, and it was really uncomfortable in that moment to use my identity to help my partner. And she says, I was born to this. Alawite identity. It wasn't a choice. But she at that point, she felt like she had to use it to get past that latent violence that was on display at the checkpoint of arresting her boyfriend.
But lowering your standards and even telling lies can be crucial to saving lives under those circumstances, surely.
Potentially, I guess, you know, like another story from the book of my friend RT, who's now in Sydney. He had an experience at military security in Homs in Syria. This is before the uprising and revolution, and he was wearing very nice clothes to the military security, and he was taken by a guard. Thought going to military security would take him all day to get his military booklet, but the guard saw him. He thought he was a very respectable person who might have had a lot of money, so he took him very quickly through the checks that he was meant to be doing at military security. And then it wasn't until they were outside that RT realised that actually what this guard wanted, a very young guard, wanted a bribe. And in that moment, RT thought, he was really troubled. He was like, I've experienced benefit from this, from what's happened previously. What should I do? Should I give them a bribe? Should I not? And then in the end, he got up the courage to shake his hand and just walk away. But he said in that moment that really, he was frightened, he was excited. It was a very complicated sort of emotional experience for him. So it just shows that anything can happen with those encounters with the state, I guess.
Through the book, you encourage us to look beyond the bombs and the destruction and the violence to the bureaucracy. And is that your conclusion, really, or principal argument, that violence can't survive, violent states can't survive without bureaucracies?
I think many authors have said how people are controlled through administration and through bureaucracy. And I think what really interests me, I guess, is legal identity documents, like, say, birth, deaths and marriage certificates, for example. I mean, they might seem really mundane, and they often are, but obviously they're also very powerful. And if they don't have the right information on them, or they have certain information on them, they can become a threat, they become a liability, they can facilitate things or not. So I think that bureaucracy in terms of the legal identity documentation, that's what really interests me, and how people are very skilled, I guess, the power of those documents, but also how people are very skilled at trying to navigate with the documents that they have.
I didn't realise that the Dutch can claim a particular particular honour in the world of ID documents.
So Jacob Lentz came up with a registration system in the Dutch occupied Netherlands for documenting Jews and all citizens, actually. And he was very proud of that that system that he came up with, because it was a very rational, very logical, very bureaucratic system. But of course, that system was used for I guess, very bad ends. And I guess Jacob Lentz's story is, again, another story that Jacob Lentz thought, actually, after the war, he was tried and said that he thought he'd done nothing wrong. And it just got, I guess, his is another example of how we can be both victims, perpetrators, revolutionaries, all of the above, you know, all at once.
What happened to him?
I don't know, actually. I don't know. I think he went to jail for a little bit of time, but I'm not sure.
I strangely think he should be honoured in some way. It seems so old-fashioned now, carrying a piece of cardboard with your name and photograph on it. That's surely over and done with. Are you going to move on to the study of facial recognition?
I haven't thought about that yet, but look, it's certainly a big big thing, and I think digital ID systems are becoming certainly something that a lot of scholars are thinking about and working on.
But you also honour in the book those who push back, not by throwing a bomb or shooting somebody, but finding the flaws in the legal systems.
That's right. I think that's what I'm really interested in, this idea of revolution. And obviously it's in the title of the book. And I think we think about the image we have in our heads of revolution is that it's this large, grand acts, usually of military violence, usually done by males like Che Guevara, or, you know, more recently, I guess we might add Ahmed al-Sharra in Syria to that lexicon. But I think what this project and what this book has shown me is that actually revolutionary acts are much more every day, and they start with individuals, I guess, standing up in small ways against, I guess, that almighty power of the law. And I think Marta's experience at the checkpoint in Damascus that I told you about really exemplifies that. But just to say as well, it's not these revolutionary acts don't come free, for example. I mean, she's in Germany now having to deal with the immigration department there, the Ausländerbehörde. And she said to me something like, when I deal with the Ausländerbehörde in Germany, it feels like I'm right back there in Syria. It's like, she says, obviously, all these governments are different, but it's like they all have to discipline you somehow. And so she herself is feeling how the Assad regime in Syria, which thankfully is no longer there, but she can sense that power of violence and the law in Syria is basically exactly the same power that's the same in Germany, that's the same in Australia, that's the same power everywhere, basically.
A power particularly conscious of dealing with strangers.
I guess very, very much so, strangers or minorities, people that don't look like the majority in the country or like the ruling group.
Do you see it in Australia too?
We do with First Nations people, or, you know, anyone that's a minority in this country. I'm sure I haven't studied that specifically, but I'm pretty sure they would have, from anecdotes that I've read, they have similar experiences to how they experience the state and why they might be suspicious of state-run initiatives, for example, like a vaccination campaign that we had, you know, at the end of COVID or something like that.
How do you live with your great uncle's story? Having written it, is it over, or does it sit with you all the time?
Like I said, I think a lot of the findings from the book, that we hold these things, we're all sort of victim, perpetrator, revolutionary all at once. I think that goes for all of us. And I guess we know that trauma travels through things like epigenetics now, we know that that's scientifically proven and that these sort of large acts of violence can travel down through the generations, like my family's experience of the Holocaust or different mass violent events. But I think what I'm interested in doing in this book is actually broadening that out a little bit more. So, for example, Israeli-American sociologist Eviatar Zerubbabel talks about an inherently boundless community of experience. And so I think what he's pointing to there is not just these traumatic events that are what shape us as individuals. It's not just a family history, and it's not just epigenetics. It's everything. Why am I interested in legal identity documentation and citizenship? You know, why we haven't talked about it, but why? From where does my flight anxiety come from? We're carrying around. Everyone is carrying around a whole heap of baggage, not only from their family history, but from this inherently boundless community of experience. And so, I think my conclusion from that is that really we have to be much more empathetic to other people, because we just don't know what they're carrying.
Marika, footnote, epigenetics, meaning?
Epigenetics is the study of how past events like trauma or mass violence like the Holocaust affect future generations through genetic changes.
Excellent. Marika, thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you, David.
I've been talking to Dr. Marika Sosnowski, Senior Research Fellow at the Melbourne Law School, and author of 58 Facets on Law, Violence and Revolution, published by Melbourne University Press. This is Late Night Live.